Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So yesterday, I told you a story about Colonel Vindman. And of course, you know that we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearing of 2019. But what was so remarkable was that we found out that he and his twin brother were in a Ken Burns documentary from the 1980s that was entitled The Statue of Liberty. And they were only 10 years old. It's just kind of remarkable. And you sort of fast forward to these young boys that Ken found. And then you find out that they represent the best of America. They came, they fled Russia, they arrived here, and they are like wildly successful in every way you want, because they represent patriotism and giving back. And so I posted it on Facebook, Ken, the story about the Statue of Liberty and Ken Burns. And so people said, you've got to call Ken, as in Ken Burns, and find out how he found these two young twins. Like what brought them into his orbit that he would include them in his documentary. And I'm going to call Ken. I know Ken, so I'm going to call him and see if he'll come on and sort of share that story too, because it really feels like kind of an interesting bookend. All right, everyone. Now for the words, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman in 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, I have a couple of headlines that I want to read. And then after I read these headlines, I'm going to introduce my guest from Slate.com. No, it's not Mark Stern, although we adore Mark Stern and have him on all the time. We're going to have a new Slate.com reporter. But here are the headlines. One just dropped on Monday afternoon, and it was entitled, Hundreds of Ex-Justice Department Employees Sign Letter Criticizing Barr for Moving to Drop Flynn Charges. And one of the things they say in their letter was, make no mistake, the department's action is extraordinarily rare, if not unprecedented, the letter says. If any of us or anyone reading this statement who is not a friend of the president were to lie to federal investigators in the course of a properly predicated counterintelligence investigation and admit we do so under oath, we would be prosecuted for it. Now, Ken, I mentioned that I was pulling some headlines. Can you share with our audience, my producer, Ken, why we're on the same page here? I pulled this off of CNN. Absolutely. And what did you tell me just before I came on the air?
Yeah, well, Jeremy, I was one of the signatories to the letter. I worked for the Justice Department in the Carter and Reagan administrations. And when I was there, I was at the Civil Rights Division, when the Reagan administration tried to pull the rug out from under a lot of Carter administration cases, a lot of traditional civil rights cases. In fact, they tried to send us to court to ask the courts to vacate civil rights consent decrees that the Justice Department had previously spent years and years litigating and trying to wow. get schools desegregated and whatnot. And Reagan tried to get us to stop. And there were a lot of similar kinds of rebellions and resignations from the Justice Department, just like there are now.
We tread this story in real time. Anyway, before I get to our guest, Jeremy Saul, which I have not introduced yet, let me read you two more headlines, and then we will get to his story at Slate.com. Former Justice Department official says Barr twisted her words to justify dropping the Flynn case. Oh, no. Would he do that? And then I went to slate.com, and here's one of the stories. This one is at the Slatest. Obama warns rule of law is at risk after DOJ drops the Michael Flynn case. I guess he had a conference call with 3,000 of his closest friends that was supposed to be private. Nothing's private when you're talking to 3,000 people, especially on some kind of a Zoom conference. Now joining us is our senior editor from Slate.com, Jeremy Stahl. He wrote a piece entitled, William Barr's DOJ is now covering up crimes for Trump in Trump's favorite place to do it, broad daylight. Let me welcome Jeremy Stahl to the program. How are you, Jeremy?
Hi, Arnie. Thank you. And thank you, Ken. I'm pretty good. I was struck very much by what you said about your own personal experience, Ken, and just the impact that we should be feeling from this letter that was signed by nearly 2,000 former DOJ employees, many of them nonpartisan, many of them former officials in Republican administrations, in George H.W. Bush's administration, in President Ronald Reagan's administration, some very important figures in the world of conservative law, Charles Freed, Don Ayers, Stuart Gerson, and just how the impact of it should be more outsized than it is, I would say. And it's disappointing to see how such a powerful letter and how such a strong condemnation from so many respected and important legal professionals can hit kind of like hit without as much of an impact as you would hope.
So, Jeremy, it's interesting. We're going to be talking about two stories today. Yours is the first about Barr. We talked a little bit about it on Monday. We're going to be talking about it again today. And then we're going to be talking about Bridgegate. And I felt like we're taking a trip down memory lane, Jeremy. It's like, oh my God, these haven't been resolved yet. He's not in jail yet. You know, I feel like, and in a way, part of the problem is these feel like old stories, but nothing is old. The problem with Donald Trump is last week is old, Jeremy, you know, because he exhausts us all the time. And then you compound that with our complete overwhelming fear of the pandemic, where all we're doing 24/7 is talking about it, because once again, he's making this into a controversy. He's dividing the nation. You know what I mean? So we're spending, and all these very important stories that need to be sort of yelled at the top of Times Square, they just seem to sort of dissolve and disappear because, oh, Flynn, that's, you know, I've gone beyond that. But we haven't gone beyond that because of the decision that this attorney general made. So can you kind of, let's refresh everyone's recollection. How did we get here? What did Flynn do? Why are these 2,000, you know, former DOJ employees so outraged at the action of Barr? And of course, as one of my friends called me up, oh, Arnie, it's nothing more than prosecutorial discretion. And I'm thinking, now this feels like abuse to me, not discretion. So can you remind us what happened with Flynn and why we are here and why these 2,000 DOJ people want to take a shower because they can't believe what Barr is doing, and not only what he's doing, but kind of how he did it. It's clear that nobody in the office wanted to sign off. I mean, it was like he had to find a flunky that would be willing to pick up a pen because everybody else was appalled at the decision by the attorney general.
Yeah, I left out a very beleaguered sigh as you were kind of introducing that and describing how, it could be kind of written off as discretion when that is clearly not what has been happening with the Department of Justice, and that's not what happened here. Essentially, the backstory is this can be said to have begun in around December of 2016 when Michael Flynn was a transition official with the Trump administration, and he held conversations with the ambassador for Russia, Sergei Kislyak, to talk about how the incoming administration would respond to then just issued sanctions by the Obama administration over Russia's interference in the 2016 election on behalf of the Trump campaign. And Michael Flynn had these discussions with this Russian ambassador at the time. He essentially convinced the Russian ambassador to hold off on responding in a tit-for-tat way to these sanctions that the Obama administration had put in. The president very vocally congratulated Putin on Twitter for his wisdom in not responding to the sanctions. And then when the Justice Department learned of this and learned that he was lying to the vice president about it, and who then in turn lied to the public about this meeting, which could have been a violation of, you know, an old Espionage Act called the Logan Act. When the Justice Department learned of this, the FBI went to interview him and ask him what he had done, and he lied about it. He straight up lied. He confessed multiple times subsequently through the course of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation to having lied about this and having, you know, essentially placed himself at the mercy of the Russians, who knew that he was lying and knew that the White House was lying about this. And he confessed. He confessed to a crime, to a felony, and he cooperated with the special counsel's probe that emerged from all of this. Ultimately, though, Michael Flynn, who, you know, was forced out of his job as the national security advisor for having done all of this, decided to retract his plea deal and plea confession after Robert Mueller, the former special counsel, left his office and left his position. And after his office was ostensibly, for all intents and purposes, closed down, Flynn retracted his guilty plea. And what happened last week was out of what felt like it should have been out of nowhere, but what has kind of been previewed for weeks now. As you described it, a sort of number two person to Attorney General William Barr, who was put in charge of the very important DC U.S. Attorney's Office earlier this year, said that the office was retracting in a way that seems to me to be unprecedented. I've not seen anyone else to cite an example of the Justice Department retracting something like this for somebody who has confessed to lying in an unprecedented way. This right-hand man to William Barr did this, and the career prosecutor who had been on the case withdrew from the case. And now it's going to be up to a judge to decide whether or not Michael Flynn is off the hook, as the Justice Department has asked, and as is clearly benefiting him because he is ally of Donald Trump and friend of Donald Trump.
So, all right. So
that was a very long-winded explanation.
No. This is life. Life is not simple. Life is complicated. How Flynn behaves was not going to be simple. It was going to be a little more complicated. And the reason why he wanted to pull back on his plea was because when he saw that Mueller kind of landed with a thud, then it was an opportunity for him to say, like, oh God, why did I confess? Like, now's the time to pull it back, because obviously Mueller's not going anywhere. So I can get out of jail card. And apparently he did get out of jail card, but it didn't like sort of show up until now. But I guess one of the questions I have, and you know, I understand that this, you know, your sigh about the prosecutorial discretion. So we know that he should have pulled back on the plea, but how did he pull back on the fact that he also lied on the Foreign Agents Registration Act forms about his involvement with Turkey? I mean, that's black and white. You know, it's not, I mean, he lied about the forms are. This is one thing about having a conversation or doing something, but this is about a form. How do you like look the other way about a form? I'm just trying to figure out, how do you keep bailing yourself out going, that's not my signature? Or, you know, I didn't fill out that blank. I'm just trying to figure out, once again, you know, Barr may have some kind of loosey-goosey reason for this, but explain this one to me. Or does that just sort of dissolve going, oh, we all make mistakes?
So having read the filing that Timothy Shea issued to the district court in question last week, I was similarly struck by the fact that I did not see a citation of that FARA form, that lying on that FARA form. I did not see an explanation or any even, never mind plausible justification. There was no justification offered for that portion of his guilty plea. The justification offered for withdrawing the other portion of the guilty plea was from the DOJ was specifically that questioning Flynn in this matter was not actually material to an investigation of any kind, which legal analysts and people in this letter have noted is somewhat absurd, because there was a counterintelligence investigation going on here. And this clearly was material to that counterinvestigation. As you noted, the New York Times op-ed page, Mary McCord, a former DOJ official at the time, said very clearly, this was relevant to a counterintelligence investigation. This was material. This was a material lie. And this was a crime, as Michael Flynn had previously confessed.
And I think I read something else, Jeremy, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but someone also said, well, let's say if it wasn't clearly on point, you were looking and you found this. Are you supposed to ignore this behavior? Sort of like, it's like, even if you can't say that it was directly related to some sort of counterintelligence, what they're saying is that as they were having this investigation, this was noted. And they're in the Department of Justice. If this is a violation, are you supposed to say, oh, we were looking for red and we found black? So we're not going to look at it because we were only looking for red. I mean, it's kind of like you're putting these people into this ridiculous box that you don't want justice to be in, because you want justice to be done. That's the job, you know? And as you point out, not only do they say that it wasn't related to an investigation, but then they ignore what they actually had in black and white anyway. So this is all made up. This has got nothing to do with justice. It has basically to do with the fact that Donald Trump didn't want to have to pardon him, and Barr said, not a problem. He won't even need to be pardoned because I can clean it up.
Yeah, as I reported in my article, I spoke with a former DOJ prosecutor, current University of Missouri law professor, and an expert who's written a very fine book about the impeachment saga, Frank Bowman, and what he noted the exact point that you just made, which is just that if this were the standard for every prosecution, when it is the standard for no other prosecutions, but if this were the standard for other prosecutions, it would be a very favorable position for defense attorneys, but no plausible DOJ attorney would want this in any of their other prosecutions. There's no way that this standard could be held across the board. And there's a reason why you can't find another case like this. That's the reason.
Well, and I think that one of the things that happened on that sort of intimate phone call with Barack Obama and 3,000 other people that were listening, where he was talking about the rule of law is at risk, is I think he actually said, I think he does his homework, he is a constitutional lawyer, I think he said, there is no other example. I mean, it was like, he was emphatic that this is a case of first impression, that this is so over the top. And what is so interesting to me is that it really sort of raises questions about the fact that we're going to be talking about Bridgegate next, all right? And what is fascinating about Bridgegate is that it turns out it's a story about an attorney general in New Jersey who didn't want to have to deal with the case, so he punted it to the feds. And then we know the rest of the story because 9-0 out of the Supreme Court, they basically said this shouldn't be under the purview of the feds. But you've got a situation here where you've got an attorney general appointed by a president, and the attorney general doesn't see his allegiance to the country. He doesn't see his allegiance to the rule of law. He basically sees himself as the hatchet man for the president of the United States. And this is just absolutely scary because, you know, what kind of guidance are you giving the other members of the DOJ when they realize that if you think you're going after anyone who has any kind of relationship with Donald Trump, he's going to cut you off at the knees.
Yeah, I had another audible sigh just hearing you describe it again so well and so correctly. And I think it was very appropriate that you played Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's testimony at the start of this program, because, you know, I was in the room for that hearing and I remember distinctly that moment and just how powerful it was and how he repeated that, because it was such an impactful and an important and necessary statement to say. Right counts here, essentially. In the end, though, right didn't count for Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. In the end, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and his brother were removed from their positions in the White House.
Escorted out, everyone. I want to remind you, it wasn't that he was removed. He was escorted out so everybody could see it. Kind of a sign of shame. And at the same time, I'm looking at them going, hold your head high, honey. The person who should be ashamed is the guy that's sending you out. Jeremy, what amazes me, I got to let you go, but what amazes me about this conversation is I was raised by Republicans. I was actually asked to run for the New Hampshire legislature by the Republican majority leader. Jeremy, I am a liberal progressive. Trust me, okay? I've never hidden it. And yet, I learned from these men. I learned about right and wrong. And we could disagree on some policy things, but I always had a sense that they did value the Constitution, that they did want to seek justice, that they did. And I am looking at everything that I thought was part of both parties, not only being drained out, but then you have someone like Attorney General Barr. And I'm thinking people are saying, oh, don't worry, Arnie, he's got an incredible pedigree. Look at his background. And then you look at him now and you say, well, whatever was the pedigree, it's a mongrel now, you know, because it is just basically, it is sold out on everything that people expect. And while there were 2,000 people from the Department of Justice that signed on, I can't believe that there is someone who wouldn't want to sign on, because in the end, he is selling us all out. For what?
Can I say something? Yes. The excuse of prosecutorial discretion is really ridiculous, because of course any prosecutor has discretion. Police have discretion who to arrest. The question is, how do you exercise that discretion? Do you exercise it in an unbiased, nonpartisan way of, I know the difference between right and wrong, like my parents raised me to know the difference between right and wrong. Or do you exercise your discretion in a way that is biased? For instance, police can't stop and arrest only Black people.
They're doing it in New York.
That is not prosecutorial discretion. That is illegal. Right. And they can't let off the hook somebody who's driving drunk just because you're the mayor's crony, you know, or you're the president's friend, or you're somebody who the president wants to let off the hook so you don't squeal on him, or whatever it is. Prosecutorial discretion only means the discretion within the confines of right and wrong. And you can't just use it to abuse the rule of law. And that's what President Obama was talking about. The rule of law requires people to be unbiased. Like you said, Arnie, about Republicans, plenty of Republicans are in public business because they want to do the right thing. They just have different beliefs than liberals.
Jeremy, your piece was wonderful. It's important for us to go back down memory lane. Even if you're disappointed, there is an outrage. That's why we have this show. So Arnie can be outraged and remind people why they need to be. I mean, I think that's the other thing is, we can't get dull to this, Jeremy. We can't accept this. I mean, that's what Donald Trump is all about. He wants to so abuse us so often that eventually it wears us out. But the actions of Attorney General Barr should never wear anyone out, you know, and that's why I'm glad the 2,000 people signed on. But it needs more than that. It needs universal outrage. It needs outrage in Mitch McConnell's United States Senate. That's where I am. The level of disappointment is that it isn't coming out of there. I want to hear Ted Cruz get outraged, but you know he won't. And that's why I'm glad you wrote this. And I think it's important for us to go down this memory lane to remember how we got here with Flynn. And what is so scary, Jeremy, is that I'm worried about the November 2020 election. But the one reason I'm really worried is that if there is an election and Trump wins again, you know where Flynn will be, right next to Donald Trump.
You know, the point that I was kind of leaning into before was not just to, you know, raise Lieutenant Colonel Vindman out for no reason, but just to say that the pattern and the habit of this White House and of this Attorney General are just to gently try to see where the line is, step a little bit right to the edge of the line, and then obliterate the line. And that's what happened in the case of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman being escorted out, as you said. And that's what happened in the case of Roger Stone in February, where there was another uproar in the DOJ, and four prosecutors quit that case after the Attorney General did this extreme step of lightening a sentencing recommendation that, again, unprecedented, lightening a sentencing recommendation of a Trump friend and crony. And this is just the latest step on a continuum, is the only point that I want to make. And it's frightening to think where that continuum might go next, as you say.
Yeah. And again, that's why these conversations are so important, because we have to bring the conversation back. Not that I don't care about COVID-19 and I don't care about the pandemic and, you know, I want some kind of medication. All those things are very true, but I need a country too. And I need justice too. And I need to have faith in my government. Because in the end, my government is controlling sort of the outcomes of my life, whether it's the outcomes from this sort of health pandemic, or frankly, it's going to be the outcome of whether we can actually trust the kinds of justice that we expect from not only the Department of Justice, but from our police and from our governors. So again, these things matter. They're part of the same conversation, and you can't separate them and you can't forget them.
If you can't trust the government to neutrally administer the basic rules of law, how could you even conceive of trusting them to keep you safe from pandemic disease? It's the same issue. It's the same question. Go ahead, Ken.
When you were talking about a moment ago, it made me think that the Trump administration has had so many horrible things that you can't trust the government. But remember back to the Saturday Night Massacre in the Nixon administration, when it was not so usual for the government to be messing around illegally with the rule of law like this. And so people were shocked. And indeed, the first attorney general who Nixon asked to fire the special prosecutor, Archie Cox, said no. And so that attorney general was fired. And then the second attorney general, the deputy who stepped up, also said no. And he was fired. And it was only the third one, Robert Bork, who finally agreed to the massacre and to fire the special prosecutor. It was unusual then. And there was a huge uproar. Now Trump has made it such a regular thing that people take it for granted. It's not even in the news, hardly.
And he's dismantled the apparatus of people who might actually challenge him on it.
Exactly. I've been thinking about this song, and I have to let you go, Jeremy. Thank you so much. Join me again, please. Jeremy Stallwright for Slate.com. I'm falling in love with the reporters from Slate.com. But anyway, I go back
Thank
to the
so
song
much.
That a song that I used to hear. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught year after year. And what Donald Trump is doing is really sort of teaching us all the wrong things. Anyway, on that note, this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will be right back, and we're going to go down another memory lane. Chris Christie and Bridgegate. Stick around.
Less lawn, more native landscaping for our lakes. On today's Current Cast. You might like the look of a clean-cut lawn, but if you have lakefront property, experts say not to mow all the way to the shoreline.
The most important thing you can do for your lake is to create a buffer zone. And this is a patch of native plants along the lakeshore.
That's landscape architect Fred Rosamulski. He says even modest buffers can trap pollutants such as fertilizers and loose soils before they reach a lake. While the roots of a plant in a buffer zone prevent erosion, the flowers and branches provide valuable habitat for wildlife. And these buffers don't need to keep people away. Grass paths can provide eco-friendly access to the lake. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
Thank you.
Part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Bond. Yes, we love Bob Henley. And we like him especially because we saw an interesting Supreme Court decision. And how long has it been since the Supreme Court has done anything 9-0? I'm just amazed. And before we grab Bob about his fabulous piece, which was entitled Supreme Court throws out convictions of New Jersey officials. Oh, no, that's not his piece. That's a CNN piece. Bridgegate ruling shows our over-reliance on feds to keep the lid on corruption that too often defines us. Now, that's a mouthful. But Bob is going to explain why that headline explains exactly his sense of frustration. But before we get to you, Bob, I grabbed the CNN piece about the Supreme Court decision, where they threw out the convictions of the New Jersey officials in the Bridgegate scandal. And what I'm going to ask of you, Monsieur Henley, is I'm going to ask you to remind us what the hell happened with Bridgegate and Chris Christie, because that just seems like just a decade ago. And not only do I want you to remind of this, but what I found was so interesting in the decision of the Supreme Court, it wasn't that they found that what they had done was not corrupt, was not wrong. I mean, it wasn't like they just basically said, but this shouldn't have been under the purview of the feds. So in a bizarre way, everyone sees the 9-0 and thinks, oh, these people did nothing wrong. And yet when you actually read the decision by the justices, that's not what they said. They didn't say they didn't do anything wrong. What they said was you shouldn't have gone here.
Right.
Okay.
So yes. Back in 2013, we had Governor Chris Christie was looking for his second term reelection. And off of his credible performance leading the state through Sandy, when he reached out in a bipartisan way to President Obama,
right,
he was considered to be somewhat of an outlier and someone who might have presidential realistic expectation of being successful. So the only way that he could really bring that to fore would be to rack up a number of Democratic mayoral endorsements from really blue municipalities and really deep blue counties.
Just stop you there. Wait, hold on. Now I get it. That's why he's so pissed off at the mayor of Fort Lee.
Right. And so.
Okay. Keep going.
Right. So Mark Skolnick, who is the mayor, longtime mayor of Fort Lee, Democrat, had benefited from this kind of playing footsie with Christie. And within the Christie administration, was what we see now with the Trump administration, where every aspect of the Trump administration is to be used for the master to stay in office. So whatever tchotchkes you have, whatever PPE you have, every physical thing that the taxpayers have provided the government is to be used to advance this fascist inclinations of the person who is the chief executive. We pioneered this approach in New Jersey, and so now you have it as a national problem. I will say that, so Chris Christie, when Skolnick, when the mayor of Fort Lee decided he wasn't going to endorse Governor Christie, then all of a sudden it was decided that they would use, the Christie administration would use their ability to control the Port Authority, which is its own crazy duchy, just for people that are from outside of the metropolitan area. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is a unique creature that was created by an act of Congress in the early 1920s. It actually has sovereign immunity. It is like the Vatican. It's its own government, and it has its own police force.
Oh, that's so, right.
They control the airports. They actually control Ground Zero, the World Trade Center, and these bridges and tunnels. And so the police force, the Port Authority, they wear real guns, and they are the police force of this bi-state agency, fell under the spell of Governor Christie's minions, who decided they would punish the mayor of Fort Lee by jamming up local access lanes to the George Washington Bridge. This happened on the beginning of September when school was starting up, and ironically and importantly, on the anniversary of 9/11. And so it had the desired effect. It created a huge traffic jam, as Justice Kagan pointed out in the opinion. It resulted in ambulances not reaching where they needed to go to. It resulted in police officers not being able to follow up on reports of a missing child. And so this would have gone on merrily, but at some point, an executive within the Port Authority who had been appointed by Governor Cuomo brought it to an end and ended it. And then the media started pursuing it. There was the famous email from Bridget Kelly, one of the defendants who was convicted, who was an aide to Governor Christie, who, when she realized that the Fort Lee mayor was not going to endorse, famously wrote the email, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee." And it was the disclosure of that succinct, I think Justin Kagan commended it as being this brilliantly brief but effective email. So
well, let me just read something to you, because again, I want to read from exactly what Kagan said. And she's talking about exactly the behaviors that you saw happening with the access lanes from Fort Lee. So this is what Kagan writes. She says, writing for a unanimous court, Lena Kagan said that, quote, "For no reason other than political payback, the aides used deception to cut across lanes from Fort Lee, to cut access lanes from Fort Lee, New Jersey, to the bridge." Okay, so everything you're just saying is, this is disgusting, it's political payback, but this is the part where I want to like hit my head. But then she goes on, "The move jeopardized the safety of the town's residents," Kagan wrote, "but," now everyone pay attention, take notes, "but concluded that," quote, "not every corrupt act by state or local officials is a federal crime." So right. Everyone, this was corrupt. This was bad. This should be probably illegal. It just didn't fall under the purview, and from her perspective, of a quote-unquote federal crime.
Well, let's get in the weeds on this, because it's okay. Important. It's not just that it was particularly the fraud statute that Paul Fishman, the U.S. attorney at the time, decided to use. And that, at the time, it was kind of like a Minnesota Fats pool shot. It was way too elaborate and smart by half. So what he was basically saying is that they were bringing this action, the federal action, because the Port Authority relies on federal money. And in executing this conspiracy that went on for 4 days, they were commandeering for political purposes the use of a toll collector and the resources in the form of engineering from the Port Authority, who came up with a cover story in terms of a traffic study. That seems very convoluted, doesn't it? At the time, in the press conference, I challenged the U.S. attorney about this and said, to me, not for nothing, but it would appear that the real crime is that a police department, on the anniversary of 9/11, on a bridge that is considered one of the top terror targets, was not doing counterterrorism, but was executing a political conspiracy that complicated the emergency response. To me, that was, you would call it obstruction of governmental administration. It was a local action. And that's the point of what the judges point out, that this is something that should have been done under the local state. And that's the problem. We have in New Jersey a problem that goes on for decades now, in my entire lifetime, where we are very much like 19th century pioneers in the western part of America. Pa, they're coming to raid us again. Well, get the U.S. Marshal. That's all we got. If we can't get the U.S. Marshal, it doesn't get done, and the bad guys win, or they become governor or become president.
let's remind everyone. So, well, let's talk about your carom shot, first of all. So what you're saying is that they had to find, wherever they could find it, some kind of nexus to the federal government in order to be able to bring it. Right. In order to, and so what they did was they used the funding through the Port Authority. I mean, you're absolutely right. They were like threading needle after needle after needle. And your point was at that press conference from how many years ago,
right,
was, wait a minute. This isn't a federal action. This is a state problem. This is state corruption. Right. You own this, baby. It's your corrupt governor and your corrupt people. And right, why isn't our attorney general, as in the New Jersey attorney general, taking this action? Why are they, as you said, like the Wild West, punting to the feds when they should own it? But that's exactly the point. They did not want to own it. They wanted to punt. That was the whole plan, was that to own it was perhaps to ultimately sort of undermine Chris Christie or to point the finger of blame at him.
Right.
And this was kind of another way of building a moat around him because it wasn't their problem. It was a federal issue.
Exactly.
Ken, go on.
I don't understand how it's purely a New Jersey problem if, by definition, really, the George Washington Bridge runs between New York and New Jersey. So why isn't it interstate commerce? If Governor Christie had interfered with the U.S. mail in order to get at the mayor of Fort Lee, it's still interfering with the U.S. mail. It's a federal crime. And interfering with the George Washington Bridge, which runs between two states, is interfering with interstate commerce in order to get at this guy.
And you could have made that case, and I'm not saying there isn't statute to support it, but if you look at the thing straight on, it was about the governor of New Jersey using the resources, or his minions, using the resources of New Jersey as a payback scheme, denying people the use of legitimate emergency services within the state. I think here that could have been a cause of action, but the thing we have here is that the entire state apparatus was ineffective, and that's been a problem for generations, where we've always been reliant, and I make this point in the piece in Insider NJ,
right,
going back to the 60s, we've been relying on the federal government to come forward and step in and make the tough calls that our local politicians can't because they're part of the problem.
Well, and let's remind everyone, I mean, again, and I'm not sure whether there is a perfect condition. We in New Hampshire, just like you in New Jersey, the governor appoints the attorney general. Right. Kind of sounds like what happens at the U.S. level. I mean, you know, Trump appointed Barr. And so the question then becomes, are the people that you're appointing understanding that they are not there to be your lawyer, to protect your interests? You are the attorney general for the state of New Jersey, or the attorney general for the United States, or the attorney general for New Hampshire. Your point is that if you look at New Jersey, guess what? They look at who appoints them, and that is where their first allegiance is.
And also, this was complicated because at the time, the attorney general, John Hoffman, was an acting attorney general. We've heard that phrase a lot in the federal Trump context, right? So nominally, it is supposed to go to through the process of Senate confirmation, which does create some kind of adversarial moment where the person gets questioned who's the nominee, right? We didn't have that happen here. So as an acting, you're even more marginal. And that exaggerates this issue we talk about in terms of political cronyism.
So let me just mirror something back to you again. God, we're getting into the weeds, but who cares? People need to hear this. So because he was acting and he didn't have to go for confirmation, Chris Christie was a Republican. Was the New Jersey legislature at the time controlled by Democrats? So that if there was an attorney general, they would have been grilled. But because this was an acting attorney general who didn't have to get grilled, then therefore there was sort of no real concern about what would be exposed, and therefore he was serving his master, in this case, Chris Christie.
Right, and in this case, it was actually the New Jersey legislature, which was democratically controlled both the Senate and the Assembly.
Yep, there we go.
That actually drove and developed whatever information we have that's in, that the public is aware of, because they did a good job going after it.
So, you know, as we go back to this, and again, I want everyone to understand, the Supreme Court did not say that these people were not guilty of bad behavior, of political payback, of right, deception. Please understand, everyone's focusing, Bob, on the 9-0 and saying, aren't you happy, Chris? Look what happened. These guys got off. They did nothing wrong. That's not what Kagan said.
No, it's also, I think, that it's being called an exoneration. And also we have in Governor Christie, someone who sees himself as a potential candidate, no doubt, for the highest office. This also comes with Governor Christie being yet another wingman for the president, talking about opening up the economy, getting on with it, talking about that more people will die as a consequence of a closed economy than coronavirus. So there's an alignment here, and we have seen this before. We had this with Senator Menendez in New Jersey, who proclaimed that he was exonerated. And when you look back at these cases, they're never quite the way that the media shorthands it. And in this case, because Twitter and social media so dominate our news, the people that make the news, that are the subjects of the news, sometimes have a bigger role in shaping it, because it's their impressions that define what it is people understand about it. And that has to do with the serious issue of the footprint of the legitimate media being so dramatically reduced.
Well, and it's not that it's only reduced. It's, we were just talking about Barr and what happened with Flynn. And, you know, and Jeremy Stahl from Slate.com was sort of almost depressed that it didn't get the kind of extraordinary attention it deserves, okay? This is just unconscionable, the action of Barr. It's a case of first impression. This has never been seen before. This is such abuse. It's unbelievable. It really is, as President Obama said, you know, putting the rule of law at risk, okay? But because of COVID-19, because of the pandemic, because of Donald Trump, because we're now in this Twitter world where nobody reads more than how many characters, because we're all focusing on whether we're opening or closing or how many people are dying, or, you know, should we wear a mask or shouldn't we wear a mask? And oh my God, Ivanka Trump's aide has, you know, COVID-19. We're so pulled in all these different directions that the tweets then define what we know. And this is, given the fact that the Supreme Court had a 9-0, you know that, Bob. 9-0 sounds like a good decision out of a Supreme Court that's always 5-4.
Yeah, it's a Haley's Comet.
Exactly right. It's a Haley's Comet. So when you see that everybody, including Ginsburg, you know, my beloved Ginsburg, went along with this, you're thinking, oh my God, these guys got off. And then you read Kagan's decision that everybody agreed on. And I guess I have a question for you, Bob. So what are we doing? We keep narrowing and narrowing the definition of what should come under the umbrella of the federal law. And that bothers me too, because that means that, you know, if you never get someone to sort of take a case at the state level because the attorney general is in the pocket of whoever the governor is, at least you thought that you might have an avenue by going to the feds, and at least justice could be served if it wasn't served within your own state.
There are a few trends here, the big decisions that this is based on. One is the Jeffrey Skilling decision, where the judges decided in that case that the person involved in the conspiracy was a theft of service case. And we see this similarly in the governor of Virginia McDonald's case, where he took, I think, some six figures worth of swag from a vitamin supplement guy, right. And the judges decided in their infinite wisdom that that wasn't quite really what was meant in terms of a fraud statute. They made a similar call to this. They narrowed, as you say, they narrowed the degree to which federal prosecutors can go after corruption. I think that that has been a trend, and there's no doubt that this further undermines the ability of prosecutors at the federal level to make these corruption cases. And I think that also, if you circle back, we can't let that prevent us from looking at these systemic issues at the local level, right, where the feds step in because the local, state, and county and municipal structures are so compromised by the corruption that too often defines them.
So let me understand this. So what you're saying to me is, if this was true and they were trying to find some sort of federal nexus, which was the raison d'etre to have the feds prosecute, but there are going to be cases where it's clearly within the purview of the state. There is no federal. But again, we go back to prosecutorial discretion. Right. And now what you're finding out is, because there's this sort of underlying sort of corruption, when the attorney general decides to prosecute, the question then becomes, who is he or she serving? Is he or she serving justice for that state, or is he or she serving the governor at that moment? So that this is not necessarily doing the right thing. It's doing the right thing that protects, you know, the person that appointed him.
Right. And this social ecology, this local social ecology, is certainly reinforced by campaign finance, by the entire architecture. Right. Right. And I would say that really the only antidote in the short term is a robust local media. And so at the same time, you have the federal government, through these Supreme Court decisions, narrowing the effectiveness and ability to go after corruption. We have a reduction by 50% of local reporters.
Right.
Who used to cover the state house, who used to cover the county seat. So it's a confluence of it. And to some degree, the corruption and circumstance we find ourselves in, even in the inability to marshal public resources effectively to respond in this pandemic, grows out of the systemic issues we've identified.
Well, and I think there was a report done, I don't know if it was by the Poynter Institute or whether it was some of the Columbia School of Journalism. They literally showed that there is sort of an increase of corruption at the local level when there is a lack of media oversight. And that media oversight is about, you know, asking the question you asked at that very beginning when Bridgegate was just starting, where you already saw that these kind of ridiculous choices were being made, and they weren't being made to serve justice. They were being made so that they could punt. You know, and you understood that and you actually addressed the question. But that was 2013. Now we're talking 2020. In 2020, there's nobody left. You know, that the media is hanging on by a thread. And that becomes problematic as well, because then once again, who's left to raise the question? Who's left to ask the tough things? Who's left to make someone accountable? And the problem is that we have a system right now, as you point out, you know, about money and politics. You know, who gets to run, who gets to win, are people who kept on a short leash by the money that gets them there. And that short leash means that they are serving who's on the other end of the leash before they're serving the voter. And then if there isn't a reporter there to point that out, then guess what? We all lose.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I've identified here is that there are real consequences for this. And going back and looking at the history where the federal government's had to step in, back in 1967, the city of Newark erupted in a civil disturbance that claimed the lives of dozens of people. It was a civil insurrection. And the governor of New Jersey, Governor Hughes at the time, appointed a panel to look into what were the conditions. It was like our version of the Kerner Commission. And one of the things they found was that one of the driving things that caused this huge explosion in Newark was the result that the mafia had gotten control of the municipal contracts, locking out local African-American small businessmen and tradesmen from participating in the very municipal contracting system that as taxpayers they were supporting. That's the kind of thing we need to have in our American history. People understand that when you don't act and when you let corruption take over the entirety of your local governance, then you do need something like the cavalry. And if it's William Barr in charge of it, they ain't coming.
Oh my God. I mean, again, these two stories today are so damn thematic. It is just so shocking to me. And Bob, you know, this wasn't planned. It was an accident of, you know, oh, you're available. Oh, you're available. Come on the air. And then I realized as I stepped back and I looked at these two, they're a continuum. They're a continuum. And yet, so I have one quick question for you before I let you go. And that is, so Elena Kagan basically says, you know, yes, this was deception. Yes, it was political corruption. Yes, it was payback. But that we can't always look at every corrupt act by a state and local official and call it a federal crime. Does it then suggest that rather than allowing the narrowing of this, I don't want it narrowed. I mean, if you can't get a bite at the apple at the state level, I do want you to have another place to go. And that other place should be a functioning Department of Justice. Does this require then the Congress to begin to look at these things and to expand the envelope, not shrink it?
Well, particularly in the case of the Port Authority Police, what does need to be examined is how a local political group of corrupt politicians compromised a law enforcement agency that is responsible for securing some of the world's major transportation assets on the anniversary of 9/11, when any kind of intelligence person will tell you there's the highest risk of something happening. That to me, if that wasn't a federal crime, it needs to be.
And yet what I think the problem was that the argument that they were using was the argument of fraud.
Right.
And so by calling it fraud, it gave Elena Kagan and the other eight justices an opportunity to say, no, you're really stretching this one.
Right.
And what you're arguing is...
In the law, words matter.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And what you're saying is that there might have been another way to define this.
Yeah.
And that would have had legs, and it might have been, you know, able to be understood at the Supreme Court level. But you're absolutely right. Words matter. What you argue matters. And what was argued to the Supreme Court, the court said, yeah, you know, well, it's kind of slimy and kind of disgusting, but not on our watch.
Well, I think had we had, instead of, I guess, the two defendants that were convicted were Bridget Kelly and Bill Baroni, if it had been Ahmed, and he was involved with getting the Port Authority police to move around cones, that would have been a very different storyline on the anniversary of 9/11. I mean, this is why we have a problem where you have this huge national security state spending billions of dollars that could be simply compromised by a couple of people trying to seek revenge for a guy that wanted to be president.
And on that note, Robert Hennelly, once again, I'm glad we went back. I'm glad we remembered. I think people need to understand, once again, I think one of your major points is we need the media. We need journalists. We need investigative journalists. We need people on the front lines that are going to ask the difficult question and ask it over and over and over again. Right. Because if they're not there to ask, guess what? They get away with it. And that just is unconscionable. Bob Hennelly writes for The Chief Leader, writes for Salon.com, writes for Insider NJ. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, and that's Stuck Nation, because we are.
And that's Stuck Nation. Trust me, I have that on my Facebook page when we announce you're coming. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
for
guys. It was fun.
And thank you for educating us.
Thank you.
Bob, we really need media people like you who just absolutely through the nonsense and the irrelevant stuff and see the broad flow of history and remind us of things that happened that we've forgotten about. Thank you so much for that.
Oh, listen, it's a pleasure. And I also wanted to, we didn't get to cover it, but it's going to get much bigger. The issue of these thousands of civil servants that are dying from COVID and their families are losing their health insurance.
Yeah, no, we are going to talk about this. I promise.
And I'll send it to you. It's going to be adapted for Salon.
Okay,
perfect. It's a really clear and present problem because they themselves are facing exposure to COVID, and it's a great argument for universal healthcare. Because you look at it, there are so many of these frontline first responders. And the crazy thing is, in New York, we got the mayor, after I did a story and some other people put pressure on it, he did extend it for 45 days. We lost 260 frontline civil servants from the pandemic.
Wow. It's an interesting come to Jesus moment where you're asking that question about civil servants. I want people to remember. So could you afford the Cobra? Can you afford the Cobra?
Exactly.
All right. Goodbye, Bob. Bye, Hennelly. Goodbye. Thank you so much.
Take care. Ciao. Thank you.
Bye. All right. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Talk to you tomorrow. Ciao.